From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Nazis off campus! U.S. out of Ukraine! Nazis off campus! U.S. out of Ukraine!
That was the sound Tuesday outside an event at Columbia University as scuffles erupted between two groups of protesters rallying over the presence of Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko in town for the U.N. General Assembly.
Nazi scum! Nazi scum! Nazi scum! Nazi scum!
Supporters of the U.S.-backed regime in Kiev clashed with a group of protesters opposed to last year's Washington-backed coup as police tried to separate the two rival groups. Caleb Maupin from the International Action Center was there.
We're here because we don't want a new war with Russia. A war with Russia would be a disaster, and the United States needs to stop propping up the fascist junta in Kiev.
Intrigue in the House of Saud as more reports surfaced that some members of the royal family are trying to organize a coup against the king, with some speculating that Saudi Arabia's King Salman could be deposed while he's in New York for the UN General Assembly debate. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz Tuesday, the move against King Salman is in response to a series of disasters during his short reign, including a precipitous drop in the price of oil, the ongoing war on Yemen, and the recent deaths of pilgrims near Mecca. The reports draw upon a pair of letters that have surfaced over the past few days, allegedly from a member of the royal family seeking to organize an action to depose the king, his crown prince, and the crown prince's deputy. Saudi state revenues have been anemic due to the collapse in oil prices. The disastrous war on Yemen has led to Yemeni army and people's militias now conducting counterstrikes deep inside Saudi Arabia, and the two catastrophic incidents at the Hajj this year have left the kingdom open to public challenge over its custodial role in relation to Islam's holiest sites, as Press TV's Susan Madaris reports.
I'm speaking on behalf of a great nation who is mourning the loss of thousands of Muslim pilgrims and hundreds of its own citizens.
Those were Iran's President Hassan Rouhani's opening remarks addressing the 70th session of the United Nations General Assembly on Monday, referring to a recent fatal stampede that occurred during Hajj in Mina, Saudi Arabia. President Rouhani called for accountability from Saudi officials.
Public opinion demands that Saudi Arabian officials promptly fulfill their international obligations and grant immediate consular access for the expeditious identification and return of the cherished bodies and remains.
Shortly after his speech, Hassan Rouhani left New York for Tehran, cutting his trip short to take part in funeral processions for Iranian victims of the Hajj stampede, which happened in Saudi Arabia. Susan Madaris, Press TV, New York.
There has been a history of intrigue in the Saudi royal family that includes the deposing of King Saud by his brother King Faisal in 1964 and, in turn, the assassination of King Faisal by his nephew Faisal bin Muzaid in 1975. This week's high-level debate at the 70th session of the Assembly continued Tuesday with the heads of state and other senior officials from 38 nations presenting their views on issues facing the world. After U.S. President Barack Obama Monday urged governments across the planet to embrace democracy and freedom of expression, several dozen world leaders brought their own concepts of these and other issues facing their own people and the global community. Among those was Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, who also currently presides over the African Union. Mugabe told the U.N. General Assembly Monday that the entire world would benefit if Africa were to reach its full economic potential.
The successful implementation of Agenda 2063 calls not just for the commitment of African stakeholders, but also for the support and engagement of partners beyond the borders of our continent. Africa is not looking for handouts. Rather, it is looking for partners in massive infrastructural development, in creating and exploiting the value chains from the God-given natural resources, and in improving the quality of life of the continent's citizens. The entire world stands to benefit from an economically empowered African continent. than from one emasculated by deprivation and with an over-dependence on others.
Half a millennium after the dawn of the age of imperialism, a new momentum for the demand by its victims for reparations is becoming evident. In the UK this week, Shashi Tharoor, a member of India's parliament, gave a speech at Oxford University calling for Britain to pay reparations for the damages suffered by his country during the colonial era. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has expressed support for the demand. RT's Aisha Ali reports from London.
This is a speech given at the Oxford Union, which has lit up the internet, more than 1.5 million views, and it's got the attention of the Indian Prime Minister. And in his speech, Mr. Tharoor, who is an MP in the Indian Parliament, pointed out Britain's long history of colonialism in India, and his own estimate was somewhere in the region of, in today's terms, £50 billion alone for just for World War II. And Mr. Tharoor making some really interesting points. He pointed out that when slavery was abolished in 1833, Britain did pay £20 million at the time for reparations, but not to the victims of slavery, to the people who actually owned the slaves because they had lost what they deemed to be their property. So he raised a few laughs in his speech. He also went on to point out that during both world wars, India gave troops, gave weapons, contributed to making even the uniforms for the British war efforts in both of those conflicts. And so for him, he pointed out that it's not just what went on during colonialism, it's the lives lost. It's the number of people killed, for example, during the Bengal famine, where 4 million people were, in his words, deliberately starved to death by the colonial authorities. So when he rounded the whole figure together, he was pointing out not just financial compensation, but also compensation for all the lives lost. And so he ended his speech pointing out that it's not that India needs any support from the UK. India's economy alone is worth around $2 trillion a year, but that simply they need an apology so that the country can move on and get over its dark past.
Meanwhile, at Tuesday's session of the UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, raised the demand for reparations as an essential element of the UN's sustainable development goals and as a matter of justice.
Mr. President, excellencies, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, in the Christian Bible, the book of Proverbs suggests that mortal men live for 70 years. A number that fairly accurately reflects the current modal life expectancy of the global population. Today, we have assembled for the 70th time in the life of the United Nations, with the legitimate question of whether this imperfect assembly of mortals has seen its best days, or if by reason of the strength of our principles and actions, we may endure to overcome tomorrow's challenges. St. Vincent and the Grenadines looks forward to the wise and experienced stewardship of President Morgan Slicketoff during the 70th session of the United Nations General Assembly. President Slicketoff, who will celebrate his 70th birthday during this tenure, can confidently stand on the exceptional works performed by His Excellency Sam Kutesa during last year's session. This year, possibly more than at any point in our modern history, our assembly is beset by global threats and risks that force us to consider the ways in which our core principles of sovereignty and non-interference can overcome today's challenges. Borderless menaces like terrorism, economic crises, contagious diseases, and climate change heed neither geopolitical boundaries nor governmental jurisdiction. Further, the calamitous fallout of military adventurism, economic recklessness, or environmental negligence is not confined to discrete national boundaries. Rather, the chickens often return to roost in far-flung, unexpected, and often blameless locales. As such, more than ever, our international relations must be defined by cooperation, collaboration, and decisive action. Mr. President, St. Vincent and the Grenadines is a small, mountainous archipelago of 32 islands scattered across a shimmering Caribbean sea. But the idyll implicit in our verdant peaks and crystal waters is now belied by the grave and gathering threat of climate change. Rising and raging seas attack our coastline and infrastructure from beyond our shores, while rains and climate volatility make landslides and deadly flooding a real and increasingly frequent internal threat to lives and livelihoods. The intensifying vulnerability of St. Vincent and the Grenadines and its neighboring islands to climate change is clear in the alternating bouts of drought and flooding that have caused hundreds of millions of dollars in loss and damage in my country in successive years. Less than 2 years ago, devastating flooding washed away 17% of our fragile gross domestic product and claimed 12 lives. Our quest to recover and to make our people whole again is a continuing struggle and one that takes place against a backdrop of hope that we are not soon beset by a similar tragedy. 1 month ago, Tropical Storm Erica struck our sister island of Dominica, a mere 150 miles north of our country. The death and destruction wrought by the storm is heartrending and serves as yet another unwanted reminder of the ominous threat of global warming and the precarious nature of our developmental aspirations in the face of an increasingly inhospitable climate. St. Vincent and the Grenadines and other Caribbean countries have joined friendly nations in assisting the Commonwealth of Dominica in its hour of need. I beseech other countries that have not yet supported this noble effort of relief, recovery, and reconstruction to do so with their utmost urgency and generosity. Mr. President, our existential struggles in the face of climate change inform our posture in the frustratingly meandering negotiations to arrive at a legally binding agreement within the parameters of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. We are 2 months away from a deadline for reaching such an agreement at COP21 in Paris. But the precariousness of our global plight is not matched by the ambition of our partners. Indeed, the posturing and recalcitrance of some major emitters suggest that COP21 may be yet another empty diplomatic dance that prioritizes process over progress. St. Vincent and the Grenadines is embracing a green future. We are actively engaged in transitioning from fossil fuels to a renewable mix of solar, hydro, and geothermal energy. Within the next 3 years, over 80% of our electricity needs will be provided by renewable energy. If we could control our climate destiny and insulate ourselves from the recklessness of other emitters, we would approach the future with greater confidence. Mr. President, the aftershocks and repercussions of the global economic and financial crisis continue to convulse developing nations. The crisis casts a shadow on our collective efforts to achieve the Millennium Development Goals and shrouds our newly adopted sustainable development goals in uncertainty. The measure of our recovery is not the health of corporations or the rate of jobless economic growth, but the ways in which we have reformed our financial architecture and the reordering of priorities that places people and the alleviation of poverty at the center of our developmental discourse. Former United States President John F. Kennedy once said, "If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich." The fortress of wealth is not impregnable to the growing unrest and instability born of crushing poverty. Our failure to address and assault global poverty in this era of excess and innovation stands as the most stinging rebuke to our existing systems of crass commercialism and unfettered corporate profiteering. In an assembly shaped by the desire to end global wars, we must remember Gandhi's admonition that poverty is the worst form of violence. We cannot simply pay lip service to people's right to development. Instead, that right must emerge as the driving force in this assembly's senior years. Mr. President, the roots of modern poverty and underdevelopment are deep and diverse. But even the most casual student of history will acknowledge the debilitating and continuing impacts of native genocide and the institution of slavery on Caribbean states. They constitute in the aggregate an awesome legacy of underdevelopment, an historic bundle of wrongs to be righted. I reiterate the united call of the Caribbean community for reparatory justice from the major participants in and beneficiaries of the transatlantic slave trade. Our quest for justice is supported by the 33 members of the community of Latin American and Caribbean states and numerous progressive nations globally. The fate of our indigenous peoples and the legacies of slavery and colonial exploitation are neither partisan political talking points nor historical afterthoughts. They are an ever-present modern reality whose redress remains a noise in our blood, an echo in our bones. These issues must form part of the post-2015 development conversation. And as part two of our combined efforts to uplift the decade for peoples of African descent. Mr. President, it pains me that I must yet again speak and demand appropriate redress on the subject of retroactive stripping of citizenship of persons of Haitian descent born in the Dominican Republic and their forcible deportation to Haiti, a country to which many of these victims have only a vague ancestral connection. We in the Caribbean community are pledged to work with our Caribbean family in the Dominican Republic to assist in ending this tragedy at the heart of our Caribbean civilization. But the authorities in the Dominican Republic must demonstrate a good faith, not merely in words, but in deeds. We in St. Vincent and the Grenadines cannot remain silent or indifferent in the face of this gross violation of human rights. This is not a migration issue of the type that is currently engulfing the European Union. At its core, this is an international human rights issue of the gravest kind upon which the United Nations must pronounce unambiguously. Mr. President, 70 years ago, the United Nations was founded with a central goal of saving succeeding generations from the scourge of war, the very first principle enunciated in our charter. Today, wars and rumors of wars continue to bring untold sorrow to mankind. Too often, these wars are the product of great power arrogance and decisions based not in fact but on wishful ideological impulses. The results of these actions and inactions almost invariably exacerbate underlying conflicts and produce unwanted global repercussions. International terrorism threatens us all and requires concerted international cooperation. Anti-terrorist intervention must not be shaped by which side of a border the terrorist armies happen to encamp, or one's ideological affinity for governments most threatened by these barbaric hordes. We have already learned that modern terrorism, wherever it takes root, can threaten peace and prosperity in any corner of the globe. Stamping it out must be a shared and pressing priority. Mr. President, diplomacy ought to be most active in averting conflict and diffusing disagreements. Within the zone of peace that encompasses Latin America and the Caribbean, St. Vincent and the Grenadines is concerned that the sharpening of rhetoric between our longtime friends and allies in Guyana and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, their border dispute, which dates back to the 19th century, has long been constrained by the ties of brotherhood, solidarity, and international cooperation. Accordingly, we call for renewed and reinvigorated diplomatic engagement in the management and ultimate resolution of this vexing issue. Mr. President, the maintenance and restoration of international peace and security has been the responsibility of the United Nations Security Council for the last 70 years. The Security Council, more than any other body delineated in our charter, is unmistakably in a period of doddering dotage, unable to act with the nimbleness or decisiveness necessary to meet modern challenges. The necessity of reform and rebirth, which is acute in any institution entering its eighth decade, is particularly pressing in the case of the Security Council. For too long, reform efforts have fallen victim to the geopolitical ambitions of entrenched council members and the regional rivalries of legitimate aspirants. This must end. We must ensure that. Similarly, the important and indispensable work of the United Nations peacekeepers around the world must be above reproach. The United Nations must claim responsibility not only for their successes, but their occasional grave failures. Our collective sanctimony rings hollow when the United Nations shirks its undeniable responsibility for spreading cholera in Haiti to the tune of 9,400 deaths and over 400,000 hospitalized. Legal loopholes cannot mask moral responsibility in this case. Nor can we condemn sexual violence as a war crime while shrugging off the unacceptable actions of some UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. Our assembly has a responsibility to be open and transparent, to meet these sporadic failings head on, and to offer redress to all victims of peacekeeper negligence or aggression. Mr. President, on Wednesday, tomorrow, I will stand a few meters away from where I am speaking today to witness the raising of the flag of the State of Palestine along other states' flags on the UN compound. The overwhelming decision to fly the Palestinian flag here at the UN is an unmistakable endorsement of a true two-state solution with a viable and safe Palestine living alongside its neighbors in a secure Israel. But the symbolic nature of next week's ceremony is no substitute for continued action to make that two-state solution a reality. With each passing day, realities on the ground make such a solution increasingly difficult. Though the conflict between the states of Israel and Palestine are undeniably complex, they are not beyond the capacity of the parties and the international community to resolve. And we must do so. And we must help in doing so. The Assembly's unambiguous position on Palestine is reminiscent of our long-standing and overwhelming opposition to the United States' commercial and economic embargo against the people of the Republic of Cuba. The embargo has persisted for 55 of the 70 years that the United Nations has been in existence, and its toll is measured in billions of dollars, hundreds of lives, and countless developmental opportunities lost. This year, Presidents Obama and Castro have demonstrated laudable courage in working together to move past years of enmity and mutual distrust. But the welcome detente between the two countries has not yet led to a lifting of the embargo. There is much more to be done to unshackle the Cuban people from the chains of an unjust, illegal, and plainly outmoded blockade. Our collective pressure, so critical to the belated rapprochement, cannot waver. Instead, we must intensify our calls for the complete lifting of this anachronism and to make whole this rupture in our hemispheric family. Mr. President, this 70th year of the United Nations must therefore be a year of not only action, but inclusion, outreach, and redress of calcified injustices. As such, we must move beyond our inexplicable exclusion of Taiwan from the work of the specialized agencies of the United Nations. The perspective, experience, and example of Taiwan as an active and responsible global citizen are self-evident arguments in support of their greater inclusion and participation. Taiwan's continued exclusion can neither be explained nor justified by any rational and forward-looking global gathering. Mr. President, in this our 70th year, let us pledge ourselves to liberate our nations and our global family from the continuing bondage of poverty, deprivation, and warfare, to emancipate ourselves from the mental slavery of discrimination and learned helplessness, to unshackle our policies from the narrow nationalism and imperialist ambition that constrains the limitless possibilities of the human spirit. As nations and peoples, we have choices. In the 70 years of this assembly's life, we have sometimes chosen unilateralism. Many have chosen militarism. Many have chosen to defer and dissemble. Today, as we look forward and we look toward a complex and uncertain future, let us instead choose love. Love of our fellow human beings. Love of our planet and an abiding love, not of problems, but of their practical solutions. For with love, faith and works and hope, all things are possible, including a further 70 years for the better of this remarkably important global gathering. We are all laboring in this vineyard. We must have a labor of love. Of love. Of love. I thank you.
Some say those sins are old and ones they do not know. But many who are here right now were here with old Jim Crow. So America, will you ever say I'm sorry for the laws made in the past? So we can move on with our future and a plan that's made to last. First reparations bill that did not pass in 1896. Many more have come, still black folks find no fix. America, in your song you sing in asking God to bless. But to bring a healing to this nation, there are some sins you must confess.
For the healing of the nation, the word is reparation. For the healing of the nation, the word is reparation. For the healing of the nation, the word is reparation. For the healing of the nation.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.